Thank you.
Good morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We will open the meeting with a reading of the Declaration. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to give it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, a sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to this association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes, and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The program for the month of June will consist of a panel, a forum, and a talk. We begin these presentations this month with a general theme called Practical Theosophy. So this morning we will have a talk entitled The Power of Theosophy in Daily Life. And next Sunday there will be a forum on meditation and true prayer. Now these meetings will begin promptly at 11 o'clock and last for 1 hour. Following these meetings will always be a time for questions and discussion. Now on Wednesday, June 9th, is a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. Now this class has been studying chapter 16 of the Ocean, and it will continue that study, which relates to psychic laws, forces, and phenomena. And this class opens at 7:45 and lasts until 9 o'clock. On Friday, June 18th, there will be a panel on a comparative study of religions and philosophies. Now this study class has been relating to the message of symbols. And on Friday, the 18th, it will relate to this idea from the standpoint of fire and water. Now these Friday evening classes begin promptly at 7 o'clock and last for 1 hour. The doors of the lodge are open at 6:30. Now on Sunday morning, June 20th, is a special day. It is a day when we celebrate what we call ULT Day. It is a time when we commemorate the life and work of Robert Crosby. Mr. Crosby was the founder of the United Lodge of Theosophists in 1909. And on this day, Theosophical students around the world will pay tribute to this special day. Here in Philadelphia, our program will consist of an introduction, selected readings, and a talk entitled The United Lodge of Theosophists, Its Mission and Its Purpose. Now this is going to be a very special meeting, and because of it, we ask all persons who plan to attend to please arrive at least 5 minutes before the hour, be seated and remain silent in order to set the tone for this event. Now, on Sunday, June 27th, this will represent the last meeting for our general meetings, which began in October and last until the end of June. There will be a talk entitled Duty, the Royal Talisman. Also on the 30th of June, we will begin our summer program. And for the summer program, there will be a study of the Bhagavad Gita as translated by William Hugh Judge. The library will continue to be open throughout the summer at 5:30 on Wednesdays. The library is well-stocked with books, pamphlets, and magazines comprising the original writings of the founders of the Theosophical movement. There are other texts of interest that might interest you, but during the library hours, there's always a student to lend assistance in answering questions of a theosophical nature. These books, pamphlets, and magazines are on display at the desk just outside of the library. They are for sale and they may be purchased either during the library hours or before or after our regular meetings. All activities of this lodge are free. The lodge, since its inception, has been supported by contributions of a voluntary nature, whether it be work or monetary contributions. And all are most welcome to participate. The reading for today is as follows. Men cannot all be occultists, but they can all be theosophists. Many who have never heard of the society or theosophists without knowing it themselves. For the essence of theosophy is the perfect harmonizing of the divine with the human in man, the adjustment of his godlike qualities and aspirations, and their sway over the terrestrial or animal passions in him. Kindness, absence of every ill feeling or selfishness, charity, goodwill to all beings, and perfect justice to all others as to one's self, are its chief features. He who teaches theosophy preaches the gospel of goodwill, and the converse of this is true also. He who preaches the gospel of goodwill teaches theosophy. The subject of the talk for today is the power of theosophy in daily life.
Do you want to read the reading? The power of theosophy in daily life. The very title raises a question. I mean, what is power? We could say, all right, take the sun. The power of the sun is light and heat. But if there's nothing to receive the light and heat, it's a potency. It is a potential. So when we speak of the power of theosophy in daily life, it requires someone to use that power, someone to reflect that power. It is itself a potency. It doesn't require that we know the word theosophy. It doesn't require that we have the books. It requires, as we heard in the reading, he who teaches theosophy preaches the gospel of goodwill. And the converse is true. He who preaches the gospel of goodwill teaches theosophy. So it is there as a potency for every human being. Indeed, truly, it is the sole heritage of every human being. And we can use that word both ways, S-O-U-L and S-O-L-E. It is all we need. It is truth, wisdom, ethics, love, compassion. It is all we need and truly all we really have. But we have to discover it and use it. Now, moving from what is power itself to what is our power. You know, amazingly enough, if you were to stop and enumerate your powers, you would run out of words before you ran out of concepts. We have the power to think, to see, to hear, to judge, to run, to wonder, to create, to destroy, to recreate, to destroy that, and recreate something else. Epictetus probably said it best. He said, when we go to enumerate man's powers, we never stop to realize that every single thing we say, every description, is descriptive of a god. All of those powers that are ours are the very powers we attribute to some outside superior being. Epictetus says it should remind us that we are gods, that we must take our divine nature and use that to reflect and then to benefit all of life. Act as a god. You are a god, is what he's telling us. So our powers seem to be limitless. And yet, in life itself, we find limits, unbelievable limits. But we'll get to that in a minute. Most of us, in this present day and age, we're overwhelmed, not by our powers, but by the powers outside of us. Like, take nature. We're overwhelmed and terrified by the volcanoes and earthquakes and floods and natural disasters, which we can't do anything about. We're also often overwhelmed by man's inhumanity to man and man's inhumanity to nature. And we individually can't seem to do much about any of that either. So for many people, life has become, how did Shakespeare put it, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. People are busy getting and spending, busy discovering ways to amuse themselves, to hide from all the pain and anguish that they feel they can't do anything about. It's beyond their power. So they hide. They avoid newspapers and television. They don't vote because they don't feel they're confident enough. We have created such a strange, strange world that when a movie star has a baby, it's now news. What a world, what an upside down insane thing. Anyway, people, but not all people, hide. We just read a wonderful conversation between two people just before the outbreak of World War II. And the man, one of them was very fearful, and the other was, we're going to do what we can do no matter what happens to us. And the man asked, well, what you and your friends are trying to do, what do you think could possibly change? And the woman answered, well, who can say? But if I didn't do something, it would change me. We think that's one of the most profound statements. And if we could all just realize that when we don't do what we know is right, or we don't seek to assist where we see we can, even if the odds seem against us, we change us not in a fundamental way. Fundamentally, we cannot be changed. We're spiritual beings, but spiritual beings with power impressing substance, we alter that substance. And then we wonder why we're less responsive to needs. We're less concerned about others. It's because we change me by how we do or don't react. So going back to the reading, How do we harmonize the divine with the human in man? The adjustment of his godlike qualities and aspirations, and have them run over the terrestrial or animal passions. How do we do that? How do we harmonize what we, for the most part, don't even really see? Well, one very strange sounding thing that we can do is whenever we do feel that sense of the divine or the spiritual or something elevating, make a note of it. Maybe it's a piece of music. Maybe it's a phrase you read in a book. Or maybe it's an entire book, a devotional book. Whatever it is, make it important to yourself. And when you feel drained, use it. It is food that is right for your nature. Your nature is calling out for it, or you wouldn't react that way. So retain for yourself so that you carry it around with you, just as you would medicine. If you had a particular dis-ease, you wouldn't be far from your medicine to get that relief from it. Do the same with that which arouses within you a love for or hunger for what is spiritual, what is divine. Equally with friendships, if there is someone who brings out the best in you always, whether it's because of the way they act, the way they respond, the way they think, whatever it is, seek them out. Cultivate that friendship. Equally, heroes, people that we see are way above us in their ability to think, to control themselves, to behave fairly to all people, whether it's a famous person and we return to their biography or autobiography to see how they were able to transcend. We think Abraham Lincoln is one of the best ones, and if we were an entrepreneur, we know we would carry around that section of his life that showed how many times he went bankrupt and started again and again and again and never complained about it, just thought it was all part of the learning process. But there may be heroes in our lives. Maybe it's our boss at work, and we could ask for just a few minutes of time to discover, how is it that you're always able to stand in the middle of these difficult situations? Do you have a clue for me? Or even a book like, can't think of the name of it, Dale Carnegie's, something about influencing people or something. Actually, with that sounds negative, but within that, there is a great deal of how do you look above you to see the skills that others have so that you can learn to develop them. It is that terrible joke, the man stops someone in New York and says, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? And the person answers, practice, practice, practice. But that's all it is. Spirituality, daily life, behaving in a theosophical way is practice, practice, practice. HPB actually says that brotherhood can be learned by practice. Why? Because it is natural to the soul. But until you start doing it, how are you ever going to know it really is natural to you? You have to practice. You have to do things by degrees. Now, many people will say, well, to a point. But they fail to realize the most successful athlete goes to batting practice. How many times a week? Drills all off-season long just to keep the skill level at its highest pitch. You look at someone like a prima ballerina, you think they must lie around and just get waited on all day long, except for when they're performing. No, go to the rehearsal or the practice of the corps de ballet, you will find the prima ballerina, all the principal dancers, are there with the entire corps de ballet at the bar doing the same exercises. Take a world famous concert pianist. What does he do when he isn't performing? He practices. It sounds silly, it sounds juvenile. Why should we have to keep practicing what we're learning to do? Because without the practice, we fall out of the habit, our natural bodily and passional tendencies pull us away. It is one of the reasons we find in the voice of the silence, beware of change. Because you go on vacation and all of your good habits start to slip away. You don't follow your routines. Change throws us off. In HPB's very first book, Isis Unveiled, she gave three propositions which she said constitute the basis and foundation of theosophical living. You may have heard these before, but we would ask you to think about them. One, everything existing exists from normal causes, natural causes. Two, virtue brings its own reward, and vice and sin their own punishment. Three, the state of man in this world is probationary. If we want to live the life of the soul, we have to take those three propositions into our minds and hearts and start realizing them. Everything existing exists from natural causes. Oh, all of these problems that I have exist from natural causes. All of the good that I have exists from natural causes. And then moving to number two, virtue brings its own reward and vice and sin their own punishment. Our problem in the West, mostly, is that we have divorced ourselves from that realization because we think, well, I got away with this. I didn't get punished. And we're leaving out the other half of our own power. And that is, set up a cause and you must eventually reap the effect. Karma causes reincarnation. Reincarnation doesn't cause karma. Karma causes reincarnation. Oh, you haven't been punished for that? Don't worry, you will be. That sounds like Yoda, doesn't it? Do you remember when he says, be afraid, be very afraid? We will face the natural results of everything we have thought and done and wished for. Accepting that changes our approach to life. Yes, it's terrible that this horrible thing is coming right at me and is going to be very bad for me, but I can accept that it has me as the actual causer, no matter who or what is bringing it. And then third, the state of man is probationary. We are in the process of learning, of correcting old mistakes, and reaping the benefits of the good that we have done. So, we have the power of theosophy, we have our own daily lives, we have our own powers. It's up to us to harmonize all of those and just do the best we can. This probation is not sinister. It is that as you fall or fail or falter, as you pick yourself up, you should be looking at, okay, where did I fail? How did I let my own idea of what I was about drop? I have more power than that. We have to begin to realize that it is ourselves we disappoint, and then the lives of those around us we often harm or interfere with. But we have to be fearless because we're all spiritual beings. Daily life is the place where we can learn and grow. And that's what we're here for, to learn and grow. And we're sure you have thoughts on the subject. Yes. Not that fast. I mean, my goodness.
You mentioned spirituality and also we're spiritual beings. So what does it mean? What does spirituality mean? Because for many people, it means many things. You mean going to church and all that. So what's spirituality?
We don't recall where it's written. We think it was Mr. Judge who wrote it, who said that most people think spirituality is sort of a goody-goody thing, but it isn't. It is a fact. What is physicality? We know it is matter in this state, on this plane. When we think of spirituality, we're liable to think of a kind of nothingness, a passive goodness. But it's just the opposite. It is mind and heart in action, in compassion, in a realization of the oneness of all life. Spirituality has to be experienced, and every human being has experienced it, even if they called it something else, whether it's in a relationship where there is an opening up of both individuals into a complete unity of thought, or whether it's with a group, because it can happen with a group, whether it's at a moment when someone is dying. Often the one who is dying will open up to the others in such a way they don't even realize what's going on, and they feel elevated and beautified and cherished. That's spirituality. We have all experienced it. We all experience it every night in deep sleep, but we come back none the wiser because we have brutalized our brains. We have coarsened them, and they can't give us the real truth about our own natures. Yes?
I was thinking about the example of practice. When we usually think of practice, it's in the sense of developing a skill for our own personal use or to help others, and that's true. But isn't it also in the sense that when we practice, we are, every time we're doing it, we are affecting, refining the lives that are within our very nature and lifting them up as well?
Practice.
It's not just a theoretical.
Right, it's an actual. Well, but you know, it's funny because when you talk about the pianist, you're talking about the same thing. What is the pianist doing? Re-educating the hands to play that particular piano piece and to keep the facility. It is always that we're educating something. And in the case of our own thinking, our own response to life, we are changing literally the cells, the quality of the cells that we attract into our body. We impress life, it moves out from us, and life comes in and fills. So we, through practice, providing we're practicing in the right direction, that it isn't for myself, but to be the better able to help the world, then we change the elements of our brain and of our body. And that's through practice. Yes?
Potential was mentioned at the beginning. So what is the potential outcome of this practice? How might we imagine the state of ourselves and the world if such were practiced regularly?
Does anyone recall? How many, Mr. Judge says, give me 500, 300, 500 good, strong souls and we will change the world. What is the potential? Well, that is up to all of us. The thing that we too often forget is that no matter what the condition is of any other soul we see or hear about or think about, no matter how depraved or deplorable, we have to remember divinity is there. There is no one and nothing left out. There is, Mr. Crosby said it so well. This is the newest issue of Theosophical Movement, and if you're not a fan of Theosophical Movement, it is the book of practice in the Theosophical daily life. There is always one or two arrows pointed directly at you to wake you up about something. No matter how low we may have fallen morally, how hampered we may be as a result of mistaken actions in the past, as Mr. Crosby points out, quote, we have not lost and can never lose our power to set other and better causes in motion. So there's that potential. But if you were to take it all the way, if you keep on practicing life after life and changing the very elements that make up your lower nature, controlling yourself and doing it for the motive of helping life, what is the potential at the end of such an effort? Yes?
Becoming a master.
Becoming a master. Mastering all of the elements of manifested life. Becoming a Buddha, literally. Yes?
So is that why that third point that was made, is that what that means? Is that why life is probationary?
Life is probationary because we, as spiritual beings, do not have our real life on this plane. As spiritual beings, we are whole and alive in our own spiritual natures. But we are, we might say, condemned, but we did it ourselves. We asked to come and to work, and because of that, we're now condemned to the probation that we have set up for ourselves. We made certain promises to life, and we are failing to carry them out. Yes?
You made the statement that I must do something, that I don't know if I can change it, but I must do something else that can change me. That's,
yes, but she was saying if she didn't work for the resistance, if she ignored it, it would change her.
Okay. What safeguard can we look for that would protect us from becoming Timothy McVeigh or something like that? What can we do to protect ourselves from that? Because there are people who do horrible things, and in their heart and mind, they really think that what they're doing is right. What safeguards can we seek to help us discern proper action?
That's an amazing question. How can we protect ourselves from our own stupidity in going along a certain path that we think is spiritual and wise? Do you want to contribute to this?
Well, it sort of ties in with the previous question and contribution that what is the goal or what is the outcome? And the answer was to be a master. But even when we're a master, we're still engaged in the same practice, but we've accumulated the wisdom and the knowledge and power to know how to do it. So it's not just good intentions.
No,
it's acquiring it's study of oneself and life and what those that have gone before us.
As someone once said, the only tuition you pay for theosophy is your entire self. You have to do the work. You have to learn and grow. But how does someone become a fanatic in a spiritual sense? In other words, they're going to kill everyone who doesn't agree with them. Yes?
And you have in that same genre, you have John Brown also was in the same thing. He was going to kill people to right a wrong that he saw. So it's not an easy thing to just, you know, I use Timothy McVeigh because we know him, but John Brown was could easily be said to be of the same ilk. But yet, in my mind, in my own mind, I still look up to him because of the cause that he fought. So I have to, how does one judge that? How does one?
Well, I don't think we're here to judge.
Not so much judge, but for our own self.
Right. We liked your question. How does one prevent that momentum and the intense feeling of we're trying to help to make something better? How do we keep from becoming a fanatic? Yes.
Well, if day and night, light and darkness are the world's eternal ways, the only way, we've heard it said here, the only way hatred ceases is from love.
Mm-hmm.
So working in the opposite direction, towards the good, towards the better for all, is our safeguard. It is our best defense in a way, although it's an active participation for the right reasons.
Right, right. Yes?
But the Gita is about conflict. And we're always in conflict. We have this conflict that goes on within us. And because of the world the way it is, that they see their gods outside themselves,
right.
The conflict is out there. But really when the battle is within. But, you know, if something comes to us, maybe we have to fight. Maybe we have to fight. And that it has to be, you know, we have to sacrifice ourselves for the greater good.
Well, you know, but in using the Gita, Arjuna didn't seek that battle. The battle came to him under his duty as a warrior, and it was his cousins that started the battle and did it for very selfish reasons, to protect what they had stolen. So it's complicated that way, but going back to the other part of it where you, yourself, because of the power of your feelings for a wrong that has been done, well, if you think that another wrong will fix the first wrong, you're not using theosophical ideas. As was said, the only way to cease hatred is by love. And that's the point at which Arjuna was falling down. I love my family, my relatives, all of these people. I don't want to be guilty of killing them. I'd rather die than face that result. So we can be overwhelmed by the strength of our feelings. But Arjuna did what he was supposed to do. He turned to wisdom. He didn't make his decision based on the way he felt. He turned to that Krishna within, which is within all of us. So we would say, as the Buddha said, first, be careful of the company you keep. Many people get involved in groups that have a sort of good passion on the outside. We want to take care of this or fix that. But underneath, there's an ugliness. There's a desire for power or revenge. So we have to watch the company we keep in movies, in books, the things we read, the food we take into our minds. We have to look for what is universal, what is all-encompassing, which makes no judge as to gender or color or background. We have to become impartial. Yes?
Well, there are two fields then where we can apply the power of theosophy. One is in the world, but the other one at the same time, and just as important in terms of this question, is how do we apply that work in ourselves, within our own nature? And we think if we are just as honestly looking at the wrong in our own natures, that'll be our best protection.
And one of the most helpful things we think that the philosophy offers about that is the people around you, at work, neighbors, maybe even within your own family, who irritate you and annoy you, are a blessing. because they're offering you, again, Epictetus. Epictetus said they're offering you gold. They are showing you something that you don't want to look at that's in you. The thing you don't like about them is the thing you are hiding from yourself. You can't fix a problem till you see the problem. Blessings on the person who irritates you because they have exposed the problem. Now it's up to you. But in, also in line with what you just said, this Felix Adler said this, act so as to elicit the best in others and thereby in yourself. So if our focus is on how we treat the world around us, that we should be treating it with respect and with regard, we will have to learn to control many things about ourselves. Yes, we are both an instrument that we are using and a soul in evolution, being educated. Yes?
The topic is the power of theosophy.
Mm-hmm.
What is theosophy, and how is this power turned on, and what does it produce?
Well, theosophy is not, quote, turned on. It can never be turned off. It is an explanation of the principles and the laws of life. The problem is we've got it all twisted around. We think that life is a physical something, and therefore everything that's worth getting is something physical. Or we think that life is in the hands of some outside being, and we have to pray to them or submit to them or hope that we are granted the grace that we may not even think we deserve. So we have it all turned around. It's all based on original truths that became the world's religions, but always there's an element of twisting it. Yes?
You're saying that we are dynamos and that we have the ability, the potential of using that power in our daily lives?
Well, don't you? Don't you think? Don't you change your mind? Don't you alter things? Don't you create things? We all know that we're dynamos. The problem is we fail to realize the dynamic things we do today do not disappear. And that could be a dynamic negative. I can't stand the way my coworker treats me. That is just not fair. I hate that that person got a promotion when I should have gotten the promotion. We create those dynamic thoughts. They don't go away just because we're not thinking them now. They remain with us as seeds. And if we keep it up, sooner or later, we will act on the negative feeling. So we are dynamos. We're creative dynamos. We have to learn to trust spiritual teachers and to turn that around. You had your hand.
There are a couple of statements that were made on the platform, and I'd like to compare them to the reading, the statement made in the reading, because mm-hmm. I'm confused. You had mentioned that our real lives are not on this plane. Arjuna also turned to wisdom. And as we know, wisdom, true knowledge is not on this plane, it's beyond this plane. But I believe in a reading, it stated that one does not have to be an occultist to be a theosophist.
Right.
Now, isn't occultism studying that which is beyond?
Is occultism studying that which is beyond this plane? Yes, but also no. You can study theosophical ideas and not be an occultist. An occultist is seeking to actually use those hidden laws. A theosophist is using those hidden laws, but not in the same way. A theosophist is not looking to change anything but the lead of their own nature into the gold of higher nature. So an occultist is not what we're about, but we can be. when you get to a certain point of wisdom, much of that is open to you. But until you have your own nature in control, you don't want to go anywhere near that power. Way in the back.
The word occultism is so like the word ocular, having to do with sight.
Mm-hmm.
And in plain everyday life, isn't it about having the clear seeing that's in sight?
Mm-hmm.
So there's really nothing so very lofty.
Right.
What's so pure and so peaceful and so healing is that insight.
Right. And that's beautiful. But we think that she's contrasting. Men cannot all be occultists, but they can be theosophists. There is a difference. The difference between a mystic and an occultist. Behind you, you had your hand up. What was that, erasing?
No, the idea was there, but I couldn't put it into words. So let alone I couldn't put it into action. So I was stifled.
But that is insight. And we should, here we go again, telling you what to do, but carry a notebook. Write down some of the insights you have. They may startle you. If you go to give advice to a friend, make a note of it to yourself, because it probably is exactly what you need to hear, but you're not going to listen. You're just going to say it. So such things are valuable. Yes?
Perhaps part of the contrast was the in act two versus in name. In other words, we can call ourselves a theosophist if we've read all the literature and we come to meetings, similar to going to church every week and giving money at the offering, but we have no intention of actually acting on these ideas. Where the occultist is the theosophist in action, which is really what today's class is about.
Well, it's wonderful that we can, you know, all do this. It is, but the occultist goes beyond that. The occultist is the scientist and is able to use powers that we can only read about. So it is a progression. You have first to be a theosophist. It doesn't always work that way. There have been those that have developed tremendous powers, and of course, in the end, it harmed them because they didn't have the compassion and they didn't have the wisdom about their own nature. So they got pulled in other ways. So occultism is a science. Yes?
I think that part makes a distinction between applying principles,
mm-hmm,
or truths, which a theosophist does, or any, regardless of what they've studied or what they believe, they're applying principles or truths, as opposed to applying actual knowledge of,
right,
laws and processes in nature. Which one is tested and verified for themselves?
In the whole process, it is one of testing and verifying for yourself. No authority is going to lead you to wisdom. You have to take the steps. Yes?
Much of what we've heard this morning, it sounds just like a practical ethics from one.
Mm-hmm.
And many people have heard these ideas since they were children.
Mm. All of us, I hope.
But that doesn't mean that they'll be done, or that they'll be put into practice. So the question is, do the theosophical ideas and teachings themselves have any potency or power to wake up the desire or the will to apply those ethics?
Did everyone hear that? Do the theosophical ideas themselves have the potency or the power to wake up these ethics inside an individual? Yes?
We know they do. We know that truth has a power unto itself, and that's why it has existed forever.
Well, we know they don't. Many people have walked into these rooms, heard these ideas, even nodded and said, that sounds right to me, and never affected them.
But that does not mean it did not affect them. It means that they just maybe turned away from it for now. And if you hear these words, they awaken something within us. We hear the word reincarnation, and we struggle until we come to an understanding of what it truly means. So that means that it has opened up something in us.
In the back?
Well, in the philosophy, it is said that no effort is ever wasted.
Mm-hmm.
So how could we possibly look at another who has come into these rooms, heard an idea, we have no idea where they've been, what their inner life is, where they're taking this, where they're going. How could we possibly stand in judgment of another's behavior, thinking that we know whether or not these ideas have power?
What do you think? Yes?
In the ocean, Mr. Judge says that during the earlier stages of our evolution, certain ideals were impressed in man's nature.
Mm-hmm.
And these theosophical ideals were impressed in there. Now, whether the lower mind is grasping it at this time or not is a question. But it appears as if there is an impact, whether it's conscious or unconscious.
Well, it is there. The problem is how we use it. In other words, universal brotherhood is in everyone's mind and heart. But they limit it to perhaps their race, their religion, the people who live the way they live. But the fact is, without even judging anybody in any way because of their reaction, what we're trying to establish is, do the ideas themselves, by themselves, have potency? Yes?
I think that was a good illustration that you just gave. Universal brotherhood, but they only apply it to the family and their friends. But that is a sign that it is there.
It is there.
In the process of becoming.
What do we do with ideas?
Shouldn't be what does ideas do with us?
No, what do we do with them? If it were ideas using us, then truth would reign the minute that it was stated. But it doesn't happen that way. It's what we do with ideas. We turn them into something useful for ourselves, usually.
But if the individual is applying the virtues or the ethics in a very narrow way, the presentation of the theosophical ideas at least awakens them to the possibility that
there's
a
more
application,
right.
And then
yes.
They can choose.
Yes.
But it does have that power to expand the mind to a universal consideration. Okay.
Think about this for a minute. How many great saviors have come to humanity? We have no idea. It is said we've been self-conscious and on this plane for 18 million years, on and off, with rests in between. How many saviors have come? How many great ideas have been given to us? It isn't the ideas that lack any potency. It's the ground they're planted in. And if you're full of materialistic or selfish ideas, it's not going to be easy for these ideas to take root. But if you have an open heart, it is. Yes.
Well, that's the point. Those who see just their family, they are those who don't even see their family. So it is a progression.
Yes.
It's not stagnant. It's constant, you know, you have those who see their family, you have those who see their neighborhood, those who see their state, the nation, and it grows. But it has to start somewhere, and it is the same idea. I love my brother. But the rest of them, you know, they do that they want.
But we can also ask ourselves, what often happens? Tragedy, suffering. When people reach a point where they don't understand and life seems too cruel and too unfair, they start looking for answers. And they will find those answers. They're out there. Yes.
So at this point, then, take it back to the original question. In most scriptures, there is the word, however that is signified, there is the word indicating there's a vibration, there's an an atonement. There's a meaning of atoning, a sound giving force to an idea as a beginning. So the potency of that word or speech or phrase, absolutely, if the one is vibrating with it, has the power to change the world. But as was said, for the moment, if the vibration is not equal or tuned to the same frequency, for the moment, it just may be a little drop on that string. And until the appropriate changes are made in the constitution of that soul, so that when that string is plucked, that idea blooms forth.
Mm-hmm.
But we think absolutely the potency is there, waiting for the right time to be appreciated and then hopefully put into action.
Well, if we go back to the very nature of the beginning of things, why did this earth come forth? Because of the necessity of what was left to be learned from the past earth. Everything is a rebirth, a recycling of what was. We have things that we have yet to learn. We have many things that we now know that we can't access because of what we have left to learn. But if you go all the way back to, quote, beginnings, the beginnings of this earth, it comes forth as a spiritual something, and then gradually is materialized. We come forth as spiritual beings when this spiritual effort is halfway through, in order to incarnate in the highest form available so that we can impress life and be impressed back, so we can educate what's below us and get educated from what's above us. The whole thing is spiritual. We just fail to see that. So of course these ideas have potency. They are truth. They are wisdom. But we are that which can stand in the way of the most potent thing in the universe. And stop and think about this and reread Genesis. It is the reason that higher beings, we don't mean individualities like the adepts, the masters. Higher beings are jealous of the power of us as incarnated souls, because we can ignore. We can choose to do differently. We are free in the way that nothing else in the universe is free. We can go higher than the highest gods and lower than the lowest devils. We are nothing but power. We wanted to read this from Marianne Williamson. It's often credited to Nelson Mandela because he used it in his inauguration speech, but he didn't write it. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. Meeting is adjourned.